The circle, like the network, will kindly pull itself together. Carey?
Present.
You were instructed last week to find out the whole truth about those bells. Have you done so?
I have.
Out with it then, Beetle.
Well, okay, Ronnie. Now look, the bell notes serve as a cue to operators all over the country to switch circuits in order that local stations can give out their call letters, you see? And that has to be done because of regulations for the public good, made and enforced by the Federal Communications Commission. I have a copy of that regulation right here, Mr. President.
Well, let's hear it, Carey. I think we ought to get to the bottom of this thing.
Okay, Bobby. Licensee of a broadcast station shall announce the call letters and location as frequently as practicable during hours of operation. And in any event before or after each program being broadcast. In no event shall more than 30 minutes elapse between such announcements. And insofar as practicable, these announcements shall be made on the hour and half hour. These requirements are waived when such announcements would interrupt a single consecutive speech, play, symphony concert, or operatic production of longer duration than 30 minutes. And in such cases, the announcement of the call letters and locations shall be made as soon as possible.
They ring those bells.
Hello, how are you? Fine, fine, cause I know that the Lord is coming soon.
Good evening. I'm Tom Rowe, your host this evening for This Week in Conspiracy Theories. And this week we are going to listen to Mitt Romney explain why he lost the election to President Obama. We'll also hear from Ron Paul about how secession from the United States is all American. And finally, we'll tune in some Georgia Republicans who think that President Obama won the election through mind control. And then we'll hear some backwards music. We'll go back in time and tune in Michael Mills' 1971 radio exploration of backward messages in rock music. It's a So stay tuned to This Week in Conspiracy Theories.
What the president's campaign did was focus on certain members of his base coalition, give them extraordinary financial gifts from the government, and then work very aggressively to turn them out to vote.
What the president did is he gave them two things. One, he gave them a big gift on immigration with the DREAM Act amnesty program. Number two, put in place Obamacare, which basically is $10,000 a family. I mean, it's a proven political strategy, which is give a bunch of money from the government to a group, and guess what? They'll vote for you. The giving away free stuff is a hard thing to compete with.
This weekend, I got a couple calls from the media asking me questions about Rick Perry, our governor here in Texas, the statements he made about possible secession. Now, he didn't call for secession, but he was restating a principle that was long held, and at least in the original time of our country, and that is that there was a right to secession. Actually, after the Civil War, nobody believes there is a so-called right to secession, but it is a very legitimate issue to debate, because all the states that came into the Union before the Civil War believed they had a right to secede. And New England in the early part of the 19th century actually considered it, and nobody questioned them about whether they had the right to do it or not. Since the Civil War, it's been sort of a dead issue, but he brought it up. It stirred the media, and believe me, it really stirred some of the liberal media, where they started really screaming about what is going on here. This is un-American. I heard one individual say, this is treasonous to even talk about it. Well, they don't know their history very well, because if they think about it, it's an American tradition. It's very American to talk about secession. That's how we came into being. 13 colonies seceded from the British and established a new country. So secession is a very much of an American principle. What about all the strong endorsements we have given over the past decade or two of those republics that seceded from the Soviet system? We were delighted with this. We never said, oh, no, secession is treasonous. No, secession is a good principle. Just think of the benefits that would have come over these last 230-some years if the principle of secession had existed. That means the federal government would always have been restrained not to overburden the states with too much federalism, too many federal rules and regulations. But since that was all wiped out with the Civil War, the states, the federal government has grown by leaps and bounds, and we have suffered the consequences. And we need to reconsider this. We should think about it. It's not un-American to think about the possibility of secession. This is something that is voluntary. We came together voluntarily. A free society means you can dissolve it voluntarily. That's what the whole issue was about. Just remember one of the reasons that Wilson drove us in unnecessarily into World War I, he talked about, well, we have to give have every country in the world the benefit of self-determination, a good principle. Of course, I don't think he really believed that, but self-determination is a good principle. It's a very American principle. So to me, it's a shame that we can't discuss this. You know, it's interesting that so many of us have been taught for so many years, and as long as I can remember, from first grade on up, taking the Pledge of Allegiance, that we have a republic that's indivisible. And we have been preached at and preached it. So therefore, there is no contest, no question since the Civil War that we have even the thought that this could happen. But you know what a lot of people don't talk about, and they really don't even know about, is who wrote the Pledge to the Flag. The Pledge to the Flag came from Francis Bellamy, an avowed socialist who wanted to put into concrete in the pledge this principle of being indivisible. And he did it, you know, for the celebration, ironically, 400 years of the celebration of the landing of Christopher Columbus. So it was in 1892. I mean, the Pledge of Allegiance has not been here, you know, all our history. So I think it's worth a discussion. I think people should discuss this, because right now the American people are sick and tired of it all, and I think the time will come when people will consider it much more seriously is when the federal government can no longer deliver. That time will come when the dollar collapses. No matter what they do and how many promises they have and how many bailouts they have, they can't do it if the money doesn't work. So then the independence of the states will come back, and it doesn't mean that you'll be un-American to even contemplate what might have to be done once the dollar crashes.
Finally, in our tour of some conspiracy theories from this week, we go to the Georgia Republican Party, which had a meeting. It was closed to the press, but one member snuck a camera in and got to hear about how the Georgia Republicans in this room believe that President Obama won the election through some Delphi mind control technique. So tune in to hear all about the Delphi mind technique. This report starts towards the beginning with also a report on Dick Morris about how Obama has a war on the suburbs. So that's next on our conspiracy theories this week.
Obama's war on the suburbs. That's what we'll talk about today. It's the least publicized aspect of his program, but one of the most important. Barack Obama opposes suburbs. He wants to force everyone into the cities from whence our ancestors fled. Because one reason is, of course, that he wants the suburban revenues to subsidize the inner city. He wants to make sure that the money from people that live outside the city flows into the city and is not spent in their own communities. And he's linked up with the global environmentalists who pushed the concept called Agenda 21 that was invented at the UN Rio conference in 1992 that says because of carbon emissions and global warming, we have to reduce the dependence on the automobile, increase people walking and biking, and we have to reshape the way we live with that in mind. So the economic concern about funneling resources to the inner cities and the environmental concern about carbon emissions combine into Obama's program of regionalism. Regional planning grants, which he's given out already in Ohio, Virginia, and Florida. The concept of regional planning under Obama is you get rid of cities, you get rid of counties, you get rid of suburban first selectmen and county executives and all that, and you put everything under a regional authority. That's the whole metropolitan area of Cleveland, or of Washington, or of New York, or of Orlando, Miami. And the regional entity governs everything. It decides on transportation, funding allocations for education, zoning, land use, open space regulations, wetlands and environmental regulations, all designed to force people into the cities from the suburbs. So traffic jams become an instrument of policy. The idea is to make you sit in traffic so long that you give up and you move back to the cities. The idea is to make it so hard to drive in the cities with fines and cameras and everything that you give up and you walk or you take the bike. The idea is to make it so hard to open a business in the suburbs that everybody moves back into the cities. The Obama's plan is basically to reshape the way we live so we live in dense inner city communities. Now, global warming is not a reason to do this. The United, even if we concede it's happening and that it's man-made, which is a big concession, the United States has reduced its carbon emissions dramatically as a result of the high price of gas, the high price of oil, and public education. We've reduced our emissions 10% below the 2006 levels, well within the Kyoto targets, and it'll be another 20% by 2020, not by any of these restrictions, but by higher efficiency standards, less driving, and all kinds of lifestyle decisions people are making. But what Obama wants to do in the name of environmentalism and in the name of increasing funding at the inner city is literally change the way we live. Your parents who left the suburbs, grandparents, left the city, moved to the suburbs because they wanted a lawn and a garden and some open space and some place where the kids could play and go to school and be safe and not worried about crime. Those will all be reversed. And every kind of disincentive will come up to live there and every kind of incentive to move into the cities. Change the way we live. So that fundamentally the problem of an inner city that's not well-funded and suburbs that are relatively low-tax entities will end. And the suburbs will be taxed horribly to fund the projects in the inner cities. This is Obama's vision. My wife and I outline this in our book, Screwed. We talk about the Agenda 21, which is the overview of what the United Nations plans to do. Please read it. Pay attention to the chapter on Agenda 21, and then fight it as Obama is doing.
Now, whether you like it or not, he's bringing to the fore and giving some credibility to this is a real issue that's affecting all of us. I want to go into a little further detail on the structure of the peace philosophy as far as the governments. We have a transportation planning director that's appointed by the governor. Then you have the regional roundtables, which are made up of two members from each county. An executive committee that's elected by the roundtable.
Exactly.
And then a citizen review panel appointed by the Speaker of the House.
He was beside himself with this.
Now, again, we've got a county council
confirmation
panel
of the woman's guilt.
Now
we have no idea what to do with it.
The problem
is, have it out on the
if
riverbank,
you live in the county,
one possibility.
You get to vote your county commissioner. So you get one vote as one representative on this council.
Wheeler.
You may not even know that he's represented on the regional council. If you happen to live in, say, Kennesaw, you get two votes. You get to vote for the county commission chair, and you also get to vote for the mayor of Kennesaw. So the people living in Kennesaw now get two votes for two people to represent them on this panel. So anybody that lives outside of Newport City is at a disadvantage. And now, we don't know whether Mayor's going to get to go or Kennesaw because they're going to decide among themselves who gets to go. But if there's a tie among all the cities in that county, then it goes to the city that has the highest population. So again, steering the control toward more urban control. The problem with this is it violates the principle of one person, one vote, as was determined by Supreme Court decision Reynolds versus Simmons. So it's unconstitutional on that level, as well as under Amendment 14 to the Constitution, under equal protection of the law. And citizens are required to have equal protection under the law. So it violates, the federal law in a couple different ways. And I mentioned earlier, I think there's some tax reasons at the state level that it's also unconstitutional. And maybe someone else can explain that better than I can. But it also diminishes home rule under the Georgia Constitution. And we all know that home rule is just local self-government. And that's guaranteed by our state constitution. This is where regional governments and taxation is going to end the autonomy that local counties have possessed to control their destinies. And if you had a statewide vote on that, which we did, if it were passed, that means the people, whether they understand this is really happening or not, they're voting, they're consenting to our regional governments, whether they know or not. And that would be very hard to overturn once the citizens vote for it. was the judge who said, what was citizens voted for? You had a chance, you voted for it. And so I feel like if this is what's happening, this needs to be on the table front and center so that the citizens know exactly what they're voting for. They're voting for another level of government that's going to be another taxing authority. It's more than just about transportation and so forth. Again, we want to see something done about transportation issues, but we don't feel like the TIA is the way to go. So, who's promoting this agenda of regionalism and PPPs? Well, at the very top, the United Nations, a non-government organization called Equally, or Local Governments for Sustainability. Other NGOs are promoting this, federal agencies. Under the Clinton administration, Secretary of State Ron Brown says, we can implement 65% of the Agenda 21 policies just through regulatory action. We don't need to go to Congress. We don't need to get approval. We can just do it. State laws and regulations are implementing this, are pushing this. Local governments are doing it, as well as chambers of commerce and PPPs. And these are just some of the NGOs and other organizations that are involved in promoting these policies. American Planning Association, Peak League, Urban Land Institute, Policy League, and so forth. A lot of things are coming also out of the Department of Community Affairs. So where does this lead us to? Well, what's the Agenda 21 going to do? What's the UN have to do with it? Well, Agenda 21 is a global action plan to implement sustainable development policies around the world. And it's basically, it's been described as the constitution for a new Green World Order. But fundamentally, it's a socialist plan to change the way we live, eat, learn, and communicate because we must, quote, save the earth. Now, I'm a conservationist just as much as anybody else. I want to protect the environment, but it has to be done protecting our private property rights and our individual rights. Back in 1992, Maurice Strong, who was the Secretary General of the Earth Summit, he said, current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class involving high meat intake, use of fossil fuels, appliances, home and work air conditioning, and suburban housing are not sustainable. So what does that mean? That means we're not going to do it if we were to implement these policies. He goes on further to say, isn't it the only hope for the planet that the industrialized civilizations collapse? Isn't it our responsibility to bring that about? So this is the kind of people that are creating these ideas, and I know this is far away and New York and all that, but I'm not here to tell you that Van Cockerman is in Cobb County or in Atlanta, Georgia, or doing any of this. They're not. The UN is not here in Atlanta doing any of this. Our own governments are doing this. Our own local city councils and county officials. They are doing this. So it's not some sinister conspiracy theory plot that's being done at the international level. I'm going to show you specific examples of how that's happening here in Georgia and locally. Some of the tenets of Agenda 21, international sovereignty, environmental protection, elimination of private property rights, population growth control, urbanization, restrictions on mobility, and really one of the most damaging things is propagandizing our children through non-government and non-government partnerships. I don't have time to go into all the details of how they use the education system to promote these ideas. That could be a whole other two-hour presentation. And we'll have some links and other information for you at the end of the day. I actually have a DVD where you can research more of this. But please, research this on your own. Don't take my word for any of this. Go do the research. We're going to give you some stuff to get started with that when we finish up. Now, this is a list of unsustainable activities out of the UN Agenda 21 program. The ones that are involved, there's already legislation that's been passed or pending. Control all these areas that are involved: agriculture, farm production systems, farmland management, single-family homes, private transportation, and residential. All the other areas are additional areas that they say are unsustainable. They would eventually would like to control: ski runs, grazing of livestock, disturbance of soil surfaces. Now, if we disturb our soil, so we can't disturb the soil of the earth, plant, what are we going to eat? It goes on and on. Aquaculture, fish farm, plantations, modern mining, on and on and on. So, to understand sustainable development, you've got to look at what the definition is and how the UN defines it. They define it, and I put this in red for a reason, we're going to get back to sustainable development. One is environment, next is for man. Number two, equity, social equity, regional equity, using the law of reengineering management. And number three, economy. International redistribution of America's wealth, replacement of free enterprise with government business partnerships. Now this little symbol right here, anybody seen anything like this before? Are you familiar with that? We're seeing it probably with a lot of plans from regional commissions, county commissions, and so forth. You might ask, well, how can we not heard about this deal? This is, we have this been going for some time. How can we not know about it? Well, J. Gary Lawrence was on President Clinton's Council for Sustainable Development. He said, participating in the UN-advocated planning process would very likely bring out many who would actively work to defeat or any elected official undertaking local Agenda 21. So, we will call our process something else, such as comprehensive planning, road management, and smart road. Now, what are some of the other terms they use? Warm and fuzzy expressions to get us buying into this. New economy, consensus, quality of life, benefit of all, social justice, triple bottom line, outcome-based education, public-private partnerships, regional, sustainable medicine, liberal communities. How about any of those terms? You guys heard any of those terms? I'm sure you have. So why should we care about this? Well, the policies are being implemented at every level of government, international, national, state, county, and city. They're using grant money to lure the governments to adopt these policies. Next, they use pleasant-sounding names to camouflage a top-down, centralized planning program. Third, public acceptance is baited by touting programs being environmentally friendly. And fifth, visioning or consensus-building workshops are used to get public buy-in to a predetermined outcome. They do that by a process known as the Delphi Technique. Now, the Delphi Technique was developed by the Rand Corporation during the Cold War. It's a mind control technique. It's also known as the consensus process. But basically, the goal of the Delphi Technique is to lead a targeted group of people to a predetermined outcome while giving the illusion of taking public input and under the pretext of being accountable to the public. Many times, the visioning and consensus building workshops are led by facilitators and not even government officials. They're NGOs, they're American Planning Association, and so forth. They're not accountable to the people, but they're the ones leading these visioning sessions. And some of the techniques they use to stifle debate or discussion or comment is that they don't allow direct questions sometimes. Now they pass out cards. So you don't get to ask your question. You have to put it on a card. You don't know if your question is going to be called or not. They use surveys that are distributed and collected without any accountability. We've had a number of our colleagues go to these vision meetings. They'll sit in round tables, they'll pass out a survey, the surveys are taken up, and we don't know where they're going with them, who's counting them. You don't know if your input is being calculated or not, because if it's not calculated, you say, well, I guess I'm just the only person here that feels that way. And so you never know to determine how much water is being generated. So that's on the way. Now, this is a list of unsustainable activities out of the UN Agenda 21 program.
He worked behind the scenes to foment revolution. she's loyal and public. Work behind the scenes to foment. She's loyal in public. Though he seemed loyal in public, worked behind the scenes to foment those revolutions.
Fomentation announced.
He worked behind the scenes to foment revolution. Though he seemed loyal in public.
Verb.
Though he seemed loyal in public.
Fomentation.
He worked behind the scenes to foment revolution. Though he seemed loyal in public, to foment. Worked behind the scenes revolution. To foment revolution. Though he seemed loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes revolution. To foment revolution. Though he seemed loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes to revolution. Revolution.
Though he seemed loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes to foment revolution. Though he seemed loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes to stir up, arouse, incite revolution.
Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, again, was voted the most popular tune of rock's history. Keep that in mind as I share this taped excerpt with you. In the lyrics of the song, they sing, "The Piper is calling you to join him." She's buying her stairway to heaven. We know that's not possible. And also they say, words have two meanings. They certainly do have two meanings. The subliminal message is, a satanic message that was put on their record, Stairway to Heaven, in reverse. What I mean by in reverse is, by taking the record, putting it in a neutral position, and spinning the record backwards, in the opposite direction. They say that, I've never heard of anything like that before. Probably not, but many people have. This is what I'm talking about, that I believe that we can hear this with our subconscious mind, and you are going to hear it in a few moments. I want to explain to you what their message is. Now, we spun this backwards in a studio, and the tape of what we've got is about to come up. They sing backwards in human voices. Now, mind you, it made sense on both sides. It wasn't a bunch of garble on one side and played it in reverse and it made sense. It made sense on both sides. They sang in human voices in reverse. Listen, we've been there. Then they sing in reverse now, "Because I live." Serve me.
Serve me.
There's no escape in it. Satan.
Satan.
If we.
If we.
Gotta live for Satan.
Gotta live for Satan.
Master Satan.
Master Satan.
The message that they have all together that they wanted you to hear in a subliminal way on the back or in reverse of Stairway to Heaven was this. Listen, we've been there. Because I live, serve me. There's no escape in it. Satan. If we gotta live for Satan, Master Satan. Listen to it as they sing their message together. Further in the tape, I came across another part that made me throw my headphones right off my head. I couldn't believe what I heard. I kept thinking about the verse that describes hell in the Bible as a wailing and a gnashing of teeth.
And that came to my mind when I heard this next sound, and it's opposite of the instrumental part in the prelude of Stairway to Heaven. Listen to this as it reminds you of the verse, a wailing and a gnashing of teeth. Again, another rock group who is tied definitely in with the occult. They had a definite message to give, who they are serving through their music. Kiss are sometimes known or referred to as kings in satanic service. With sadomasochistic chains and demonic painted faces, they jump on stage, some wearing crosses, puking blood, singing, "God of Rock and Roll will steal your virgin soul." Maybe the virgin souls they are referring to are the 8 and 9 year olds that they have comic books directed to in which they are referred to as demons. The paraphernalia that are available to kids in regards to Kiss includes jeans, dolls, Halloween costumes, eyeshadow, shampoo, soap, cologne, necklaces, hats, belt buckles, and it's endless. The gross for 1 year of paraphernalia for Kiss products is $117 million. One rock magazine calls them fire-breathing demons from rock and roll hell. Their comic book editor said this of the children's obsession with Kiss, and I quote, "At first parents' reaction will be total revulsion. Then they'll just shake their heads in dismay and go back to watching TV. Don't be that way, Christian parent." Kiss had a television special which featured the groups exhibiting psychic phenomena, enlarging their boundaries of power to the supernatural. And this was directed to the children. Ex-Kiss drummer Peter Criss said this. He boldly declared, "I find myself evil. I believe in the devil as much as God. You can use either one to get things done." Gene Simmons, one of the singers of the group, who is known for his extended serpent-like tongue, which incidentally is an ancient pagan symbol for demonic worship, said, and I quote again, "If God is hot stuff, why is he afraid to have other gods before him? I've always wanted to be God." He was also known of boasting to People magazine of sleeping with 1,000 women. A Detroit rock promoter said this of Kiss in Circus magazine. "It's almost like a Hitler rock because that audience, because of their beat, they're mesmerized by the music. They have that audience hypnotized." Recently, a teenage Christian girl came to me complaining of her room turning almost a eerie and a deathly cold. She's been having other things strange happening to her. I asked her at that time what type of music she was listening to, and she said she was totally obsessed with Kiss. And I said, "How obsessed?" A 6-foot poster of the group in her room. She says, "It's getting to the point where I can't go to sleep without listening to them as I fall asleep. She says, I can't even do my homework. I know my parents are worried about me." She turned her life, turned her music over to Jesus Christ. Since then, she's had total freedom. She burned those records, and she hasn't had a problem like that since. Kiss is also known for their repetitious heavy metal sound, a repetitious hypnotic beat. With that in mind, I want to share with you another tape excerpt from the Beatles' Revolution No. 9. As they repetitiously repeat, number nine, number nine, number nine.
Number nine, 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 number nine.
We reversed that number nine because it seemed that there would be a message there, and there was. The Beatles had a message for you to hear in their Revolution No. 9. Opposite of that, they say, "Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man.
Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on, dead man."
From the Beatles' Revolution No. 9.
A drag term on the street for homosexual is Queen. The music group Queen has a message for you.
In their album Night at the Opera, they sing Beelzebub, has a devil put aside for me. In their hit Another One Bites the Dust, their hidden message, in reverse, is some of us smoke marijuana. Listen to this tape excerpt. As I also note, the second time through, I left the tape on so you could hear through finger control me move the record frontwards and reverse for the message, some of us smoke marijuana.
Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. Ow! Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey! Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey, hey,
heard of group after group who worshipfully sing for Satan. They know he is real. God tells us he's not willing that any should perish. And that includes Mick Jagger and Alice Cooper and all of the rock singers. But they have a choice to make. What about you? What do you choose?
Round and around and around. Round and around and around. Round and around. Will tumble to the ground. The one I love has let me down. I lost the wonder of his kiss. How could he leave me here like this? Oh, stop the world and let me on. This burning up inside, I know his love for me has died. I lost the wonder of his kiss. How could he leave me here like this? Oh, stop the world and let me on.
Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research, a strategic and tactical methodology developed under military management in England during World War II. The original purpose of operations research was to study the strategic and tactical problems of air and land defense with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies. It was soon recognized by those in positions of power that the same methods might be useful for totally controlling a society. Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its manner of functioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of a chemical reaction, originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder, from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of a banking magnate instead of a military general. The silent weapon makes no obvious explosive noises, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily social life. Yet, it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with daily social life, i.e., unmistakable to a trained observer, one who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon, and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong, but because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves. When a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public adjusts, adapts to its presence, and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until the pressure, psychological via economic, becomes too great and they crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobilities of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. Repetition breeds suggestibility. Repetition breeds suggestibility. I am not suggestible. I am not open to suggestion. Repetition breeds suggestibility. I am not open to suggestion.
In Washington, D.C. today, Republicans and Democrats in the Senate reelected their party leaders and laid out their policy priorities for the short term before the holidays. Both sides have also been angling for the allegiance of newly elected independent Senator Angus King from Maine, who only made a decision after learning that remaining completely neutral would cut him out of the committee process.
And so I have decided to affiliate myself with the Democratic caucus, because doing so will allow me to take independent positions on issues as they arise, and at the same time will allow me to be an effective representative of the people of Maine.
King noted that the only two independent senators currently serving in Congress, Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, also caucus with the Democrats. With the membership and leadership of the Senate hammered out, lawmakers are getting down to business. But with the Farm Bill, Defense Authorization Act, Violence Against Women Act, Hurricane Sandy Disaster Aid, and U.S. Postal Service Rescue Bill still left incomplete, the Senate is using its first days back in session to consider the Sportsman's Act, which allows for more hunting and fishing on public land. Lawmakers are scheduled to consider a cybersecurity bill next, which has privacy and civil liberties advocates concerned. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced he's planning to bring one of President Obama's priority bills up for a vote, a cybersecurity measure that would facilitate more information sharing between private companies and the government. The Senate rejected the same bill in August after some Republicans said it would put too much pressure on businesses and some Democrats said it would violate users' privacy. Those lawmakers, including Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, remain concerned about increasing government access to personal consumer data.
I've made it clear that I think, for example, to ignore privacy issues as it relates to the cloud, given the growth that we're seeing in that area, would be a big mistake. So that, ensuring the social media, doesn't get harmed in the course of, the cyber bill, those are the issues I'm interested in. I mean, I'm a privacy hawk, but I believe that it's possible to strike a balance, particularly because I'm on the Intelligence Committee, to fighting terror relentlessly and still being sensitive to people's personal liberties.
Wyden had previously threatened to put a hold on the bill, but he now says he's waiting to see what amendments, if any, are considered. Since it was first introduced in the spring, there have been several key changes to the bill that Michelle Richardson with the American Civil Liberties Union says make it better than the version passed by the Republican-controlled House.
They made sure that when companies share cybersecurity information, that they share it with civilian agencies instead of military ones. Competing proposals, for example, in the House, the bill called CISPA, will allow these companies that hold our very private information to give it directly to the NSA and DOD. Another change that they made in the Senate bill is a requirement that these companies make a reasonable effort to take out personally identifiable information before they turn it over, so that they're not sharing unnecessary private details that could be used to trace back this information to you, the consumer, unless it's absolutely necessary to respond to an actual cyber threat.
But Richardson and some lawmakers, including Kentucky Republican Rand Paul, say many troubling provisions from the original bill haven't yet been addressed.
You know, one of the proposals is to give the internet companies immunity, but when you give people immunity, that means they don't care about honoring my contract. The only way to have privacy is to have a corporation say they're not going to reveal my information, but if they have immunity for revealing my information, they're most likely going to reveal my information. So I don't want anything that has any kind of immunity in it. I think that's a big mistake.
A report from Google released this week shows that this kind of information sharing is already taking place. In the first half of 2012, U.S. government agencies made nearly 8,000 requests for user information from Gmail, search histories, Google Docs, and other Google products, a 26% jump from the previous 6 months. In total, U.S. officials asked for information from more than 16,000 accounts over those 6 months, more than any other government in the world. Richardson says the Google report proves that the U.S. government doesn't need more ways to access private data.
There are many ways for the government to request information from companies already. Through criminal and foreign intelligence investigations, there's different ways to subpoena the information, to get warrants, to make informal requests in emergency situations. There are really a lot of ways to already get this information.
If the Senate does pass the bill, the differences between it and the House's more invasive CISPA version would have to be worked out in conference. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Ha ha ha!